I coordinate three studios that they have, and at the same time spend a fair bit of my time acting as a consultant, a co-producer, and occasionally a producer of video documentaries about the Middle East, in as far as the Christians of the region are concerned with any given issue. And they're concerned with everything from peace to dogma and theology. So we try to, in fact, do a sort of reverse mission from the Middle East back to the Western world, to the churches in the Western world and their agencies who are involved in the region. And our relationship with that part of the world, you might say, has been bad enough that we're starting with a couple feet in the ditch. And we have to get out of that ditch to be able to even think about mission and ministry to that part of the world. The hour we have today will be sort of a summary of what was said last week in five sessions. And some people are really gluttons for punishment. I see a few repeat offenders.
I thought I was getting the first session of this.
Parables is next door. No, you're free to walk out, Bill. The premise of the session is really twofold. In the first instance, we can ask ourselves, I think, quite honestly, whether we do know the Arabs and whether we will ever know the Arabs and the Arabic-speaking peoples of the world. And the second point is that those who go and make an effort to get to know them, or those who go and make an effort to see the other side of the coin, or the other sides of the coin, of the many conflicts in the region, invariably, in my experience, come back changed people, come back people whose understanding has been greatly altered by the realities that they find out there. What I'd like to cover in this little time we have is then a little bit on our image of the Middle East and its peoples, some of the consequences of that image and those images, and then some of the realities which amazingly easily shatter the images that we have. The images we have aren't very durable once we get down to the facts. Now, on the image side, let's engage in a little bit of associational thinking. And may I ask first, how many of you have actually been to the Middle East or any part of it? What countries?
We lived in Saudi Arabia for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 70s.
I see. In what part of Saudi?
In Dhahran.
Uh-huh.
We went into Jordan and to Syria and into Egypt.
So you did a bit of
Iran.
Bit of traveling then too.
Uh-huh.
And
in Israel about 6 years ago on a business trip, just 10 days.
Uh-huh. Anybody been to Israel as part of a pilgrimage? Okay, well then I guess I can say anything I want. But let's engage. The point here is image, an image we all have, even if we haven't been there. It doesn't stop us from having images, especially in this day of media. And as a media person, this whole session is oriented really towards media and their role in our understanding and in our ability to witness. What comes to your mind when we say Middle East? You know, speak from
conflict.
The stomach. Conflict? Okay. Other words that just come to your stomach, not your brain.
Hot.
Okay.
Oil.
Let's put that one on the bottom. Bottom line.
Hotheads. They suppress the women.
Okay. Women. Sort of.
Yeah.
Like this. Hostages. Some
hostages. Hotheads.
Does that go with hot up here?
No.
Let's talk about weather.
Doesn't it?
Fundamentalism.
Excuse me?
Fundamentalism.
Fundamentalism. You guys would all pass the course. Fundamentalism?
Oil.
Oil, we got it. It's the bottom line.
With fundamentalism, secularism in Israel.
Okay.
Secular Judaism.
Other images?
Refugees.
Refugees? Oh, doesn't always make the list.
Extremism.
Extremism.
Religion poor.
Terrorism.
Terrorism. And I would just say, by way of confirmation, the number of times people here have said, where do you live at breakfast, you know? And we say, in the Middle East. And they say, oh boy, that must be really bad. That's a confirmation of this kind of thing. We're sort of living with all these things in the minds of a lot of us when you say you're living in the Middle East. Which countries come to mind when we say the Middle East? What geographical description are we talking about?
Iran.
Got a little map up here. Can you see it? How far this way would you go?
Egypt.
And how far this way?
About Iran. As far as Turkey.
Turkey.
Yeah.
Iran, I guess.
Okay. Well, you people are describing something that is a little narrower than I think. If you look in an encyclopedia, they might run you all the way out to Morocco, and all the way over to Afghanistan, but Iran. But it's sort of the standard definition includes this crescent, what we're talking about, but a bit more than that as well, and it becomes a very troubling kind of a label to use. The name Middle East is part of our problem. It's very imprecise, and it covers over an enormous amount of variations, as you perhaps saw even in the little traveling you did, and if anybody travels further afield. What we would be referring to, I think most of us, is what you've said here, say from Egypt to Iraq, and including Turkey, and perhaps including Iran. But remember that Iran is not Arabs, and Turkey is not Arabs. So, and if you call an Egyptian an Arab, he might not show what he thinks, but he might not think so well of you, because they have their own history that is not the same as the real Arabia by any means. We use Arabic peoples, Arabic-speaking peoples, the big language group, interchangeably with Arabs, and that's also part of the image, I think, that we need to keep in mind. A real good case can be made to say that we either use a term Arab East to refer to this part of the world, and we've just put Egypt back under the label Arab again, because that in Arabic they use that term for this part of the world. Or I sort of like throwing away the word East, because East of what?
Yeah.
You know, obviously East of something that's west of here, and what? Guess what's west of here? Us!
That's right.
You know? Anybody know where the term came from? An American naval strategist in 1902 named Alfred Thayer Mahan cooked it up as a way to describe that part of the world. And the guy whose name is on the treaty, Sykes-Picot Treaty, where you heard about during the war, where all those funny lines were drawn in the desert that nobody believes, Mr. Sykes popularized it, Sir Mark Sykes. So it's a Western, and very much of a Western imperialist term, because it's saying it's east of us. So I'd rather argue that... I don't know. They get their oil from there, though, so they probably have a real good name for it. I'd rather call it the Middle, because you have three of the five big or six big continents intersecting. Africa, Asia, and Europe intersect there. And it's the place from which our civilization came. It's the cradle of civilization by all counts. The only people who can dispute that would be the Chinese, and they can dispute it, but it's a separate development. Our Western civilization and this whole Middle Eastern civilization began there. It's a place where writing was invented, where cities first developed, where animals were domesticated. Any number of things that we take for granted at the very beginning of our history, agriculture began in the area of Mesopotamia especially, and in Egypt. And some of the timelines going back in a place like Egypt are just, you know, when everybody else is looking around in the mud for worms to eat, the Egyptians are building temples that would stand up to scrutiny on Park Avenue today. So you've got some amazing things going on there. These images, if you think about them for a minute, and then you think about a recent event which is still very much in our minds, and as I've been around a little bit this summer speaking in different places, I find a fair bit of resentment at the whole episode, the Gulf War. What did you learn about the Middle East from the Gulf War? Anything new? Anything different?
How alliances shift.
Yeah.
And how varied it is in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that it is a bit more varied than we perhaps thought. But did we learn much about the region from the war? I liked both comments. Can we have them one at a time?
The difference in the way war was fought, that the equipment had to be different, and the terrain was so different.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and then somebody was saying that we fought the war.
Reinforced the images.
Right. Mm-hmm. We fought the war with these images intact, and in fact, we used these images very much as part of the war. And in a way, I think it's fair to say the Gulf War told us a lot more about ourselves than it told us about the Middle East.
But it's just recent that Iraq was our buddy and Iran was the bad guy. And then it just switched, particular personalities involved switched.
Which, mm-hmm. Which also tells us more about ourselves than about them. Yes?
I did some reading and studying about the religious conflicts that were going on over there, and some of the history behind it, which is something that I was totally unaware of.
Right. Did that affect your view of the news and the war at all?
I found the news all really confusing. I didn't find any really good documentation in the news about what was going on that sort of pieced things together for me.
No effort really to relate what you were learning in your reading to this episode that we were getting ourselves into, perhaps, or not much of an effort.
No.
Yeah. And if you make that effort, you very quickly start backing off from the war. Even as you might do the same thing, back off from it, if you look at what's happened since. I mean, what did it achieve for us, really? But we'll get into that a little bit more. Yes?
Our government didn't have to work very hard to demonize the enemy in this country. They've been doing it ever since the hostage crisis.
Absolutely.
They didn't have to put much effort to demonize the
enemy. Key point. That was a war just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all there, and our leaders had the guts to walk into it and take advantage of it. I really think that's serious. Absolutely, and we haven't undone the demonization. We haven't undone the hotbed that we wallowed in. We had the privilege of just getting to our mission station in Cyprus in time for the war, and my first day at work was with the presidents of 18 major denominations of the U.S. churches, including Bishop Chilstrin of the ELCA, who were in Cyprus. And we're going to Baghdad, some of them, and to Lebanon, and to Israel, and the occupied territories in Egypt, to speak at the highest possible levels to the governments to say that the whole American people were not behind this frenzy that was being whipped up. This was about December 16th, December 17th, about a month before the air war. So we had the privilege of being there for it when it happened. My first time in my life working in close proximity with all Arabic people, going to the office with the same people that my country is bombing in the morning, and then witnessing not the air war as such, because it was over the horizon and we couldn't even hear it, of course, it was 200-300 miles away, but the second air war, the other air war, which was waged by the media, and especially CNN, where the whole region switched over to the aggressor's broadcasting systems and heard about what was being done to them from the people who were doing it to them. So you had a remarkable demonstration of the order, the international order, where not only big military was having its heyday, but big media were also. And to sit there and hear all this talk about surgical strikes and all these things, which had not a sliver of recognition of the people. And there's great studies here. I've got some if you're really interested in more analysis of it or haven't seen that kind of thing. But even the language used to describe Scud missiles versus Patriot missiles. Scuds were demonic things, and Patriot missiles were wonderful tools of freedom and defenses of innocent people. All these things that we know about feed into our own problem with the region and do nothing to get us past the images. And in fact, as we said, the war was waged on that basis. And the region was nothing more, honestly, than a war movie set. Even the way they started the newscast. I want you to stay, if you can, in your seat with perhaps a little bit of turning around towards these TV sets. And I'm going to play for you about 4 minutes of a documentary done by two Arab Americans who have taken existing footage from the networks and from Hollywood movies, and made a 45-minute documentary about how we view the Middle East and how we as Westerners portray Middle Easterners as characters in our news and characters in our movies. This is just one little segment, and it begins with Mr. Rogers. The documentary ends with a screen and Elvis Presley, another cut of him in that harem movie, and the people watching it are all wearing Arabic headdresses and they're clapping at the end of the Elvis Presley movie. And it points to another, yet another twist in the whole story, is that we laugh at this, but if you sit next to an Arab, or if you think twice about it, or you see it twice or three times, you don't tend to laugh anymore. And when you sit next to an Arab and you talk about them, it with them, the reactions are very mixed, and it's like somebody dealing with their own self-image and not knowing exactly what to do about it. In a way, you can meet people without too much trouble in the Middle East who basically believe this about themselves. You can also meet a lot who are mad as hell about it and are going to kick you right out the door if they had the chance, or your country, or your president, or your armed forces. And there are a lot of people, of course, who are not infected, but it's a big problem. And I think that if we analyze stereotypes, we know that where you have heroes, you also have villains. It's the old cowboys and Indians scenario. And in the Middle East, the cowboys, who are the cowboys? The cowboys are us, but the cowboys are also, in this day and age, the Jewish people, who, very ironically, because they have had their own dose of stereotyping and bad imagery throughout history, much of it at the hands of Christians. But in the Middle East, they are billed as the only democracy, our friend there, our ally, our trusted ally. They come off looking pretty good. There's also the people who qualify for our romantic image, the Lawrence of Arabia's type figures, and a few of the dashing, maybe sheikh on the camel racing across the desert, the Arabian Nights kind of thing. But by and large, it's the Arabs who fill the role of villain, who are portrayed as treacherous, who are villainous, and nothing does it more graphically and more simplistically than the cartoons images that you've seen. How familiar a figure that is for us. And an Arab-American professor at Southern Illinois University did a study here on the Arab in comic books. And he analyzed 215 comic books and came up with 218 Arab characters, and 150 of them were strongly negative, and a few were mildly positive, and he analyzes the impact of that from people who have no idea about the region, but doesn't stop them from creating mass media, which have some, who knows how much, impact on forming our region our image of the region. I'd like to draw the parallel, too, with this quincentennial, the 500 years of us white folks in this part of the world. We did something here that we will never be able to undo. We took people's land. Of course, there was a lot of it that maybe wasn't so full, but we took a lot of it that had people in it. We took their land, and then what have we been doing until very recently, and will continue to do? We've been villainizing, we've been negative stereotyping the people whose land we took. Dances with Wolves was an exception, because it turned the corner on that. The question that comes to mind is, and the parallel in the modern Middle East is with the occupied territories and the way the Israelis feel about themselves for having taken people's land, is it possible to take somebody's land and to still see them in a good light or in an accurate light, an honest light, to see them and to see their integrity? Probably is a fairly difficult thing to do psychologically after you have moved into where they used to live. Are there comments or questions? Yes.
So how does it fit into the fact that there are a certain amount of fundamentalism there that's pretty radical and pretty extreme, and I got to talk to somebody from Saudi Arabia, and the women there were absolutely, suppressed to the extreme conditions. So that is true. It's truism there.
There is truism, but the question is how much, on the one hand, if you just want to keep the argument over there. The other question is, what are the parallels in our society, for me at least? And fundamentalism, I think you have a very strong case to debate there about whether our fundamentalism is any stronger or any weaker than theirs.
And I dislike that too.
Pardon?
I dislike that too.
Right, and there you go, I think, in a more helpful direction, to see fundamentalism as a way to describe human society or an aspect of human society, but not to use it as one more weapon against the disadvantaged people. And we're talking about the masses of the Arabs when we talk about these stereotypes. Some of their rulers could do with some down-putting, I think. I mean, there's no love lost with some of the rulers in the region. But it's the mass of the people who come out on the short end of the stick here. And they don't deserve the label fundamentalist any more than you or I do. And that's a fact. I mean, if you go to the region, you cannot support that notion that it's a region of fundamentalists. It just doesn't hold up when you go there.
They're trying to get power, though.
Pardon?
They're power in Iran. They're trying to get power in Egypt.
Right, but they're an active minority. And they're
power, though. It's like they're ruling. Or trying to.
Mm-hmm.
They're
on the Republican Party.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, who wrote the Republican platform this last week, you know? And wouldn't they like to be in power, too? I mean, at every point, there's a parallel to our own society. We have a better, more of a democracy, somewhat, you know, and a more of a tradition, more of a government of laws rather than people, which protects us a little bit from the same elements in our own society. They don't have that. They have the added twist, and it's far beyond me to explicate it, but the added twist that they have never made this fairly false separation between religion and state, which ought to trouble us to death as Christians. Bishop Chilstrom in his GME, Global Mission Event, addresses this year, said that if you answer yes to the question, do I live in a Christian country? If you answer yes to that question, he said, you've got a big problem and you will never have any mission worth the name. So it comes quickly into that too, because the fundamentalists there are trading on the fact that religion has not been divorced from public life. Muslims say that their religion is not a religion, it's a way of life. And that's by way of saying that you can't leave it to the government to do some things and religion to do other things. And the Christians going off to church on Sunday morning and then coming off on Monday and bombing them or acting in the region with the kind of things that we often act there, just in the region, let alone what we do in our own country. They know what goes on here. So they're quick to point that out and to say, why point at us for trying to go around the tree a different way? But it does open the door to more crazy religious people who get into power. The reason why we separated the two, you know?
It isn't also true that Islam, it's part of their tenets that they promote rule by violence if need be to make their sacred
position? I can't debate that, but I think that it's honest to say that that streak in any religion, which we have in Christianity and Christian history too, perhaps went a little further under Islam than it has with Christianity. But the minute you say that, you have to turn around and think about the religious wars in Europe, the centuries of fighting.
But that was not in the Bible. That was abuse of the Bible.
Right. Well, but if you go looking for it in the Quran, you won't find much more than... You'll find less than you'll find of the Israelites wailing on their neighbors in the Old Testament. Well, okay.
Wait a second.
Yes.
I want you to prove me wrong, because I feel very much as a woman thinking about the Middle East, as if I were black and you're asking me to like the Ku Klux Klan and saying, oh, we're no better than the Ku Klux Klan. And I think, you know, I'm sorry, tell me how I'm wrong. And also, in this country, we're not performing genocide on women and children and little babies and dropping chemical weapons on them and so forth. Now, I know that's the leaders, but nobody is really overthrowing Saddam Hussein either, and with what he's doing with the Shiites and the Kurds. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like his countrymen are rising up against him. In fact, they go out in the street and wave banners saying how much they love him. And how do you make that?
No.
Make me wrong.
All right. I don't, you know, maybe I can't do that, but almost every point that you mention requires a decent conversation.
I know.
And on the women thing, I would just say, go and meet some Muslim women and ask them how bad they feel. And some will feel bad, but a lot of them won't. A lot of them will stick up for their life and they'll recognize the shortcomings and they'll also recognize the strengths and say, if they know you well enough, they'll say what they think they have that you don't have as a woman, despite all your liberation. in terms of family values or in terms of a definite place. But it's a different, again, a different kettle of fish. And you can't say that our way is the only way or necessarily the way of progress. That's one sort of thing. And you can even read, I have some material, I don't think it's here, on women writing on the strengths of the veil, the creation of a private space in which they can be themselves behind that veil. And very few actually are all the way covered up, of course, too. But that comes into it. It also comes into it that you're safe. My wife, you could walk through Cairo at 2 o'clock in the morning, a city of 14 million people, and your chances of being molested are probably, you know, 1 in 1,000.
Even as a Westerner?
Yep. Even as a Westerner.
Really?
Yep. So it's not as simple as to say this is bad. This is bad. I'm not saying what you pointed out is good. But I'm saying there are so many mitigating factors or balancing factors, like in our own society. We got good things, we got bad things. So do they. The bit about the leaders, the best way to answer that is to say, go back and read, I can give you about how the modern Middle East was created and how the Kurds and the Shiites and the Sunnis in Iraq, Saddam Hussein's people being the Sunnis, were thrown together into a country.
By the British.
And the gist of the book is, the modern Middle East was established 70 years ago. The jury is still out on whether or not the people who live there are going to accept the settlement that was put on to them. So what he did to the Kurds, what he did to the Shiites is terrible. But the US of A has the largest number of people of its population in the world in prison. Per capita, we have more prisoners than any other country. And we're a huge country, so that's a lot of prisoners. There are parallels to that, too. Parallels in the degeneration of life in the inner cities and in our own minorities, our own Kurds, our own Shiites. What our problem is that our media and our learning and our prejudice and our ignorance, I think, allows us to just get confirmed again and again in these things and to not see the fact that there's a balance to many of them, even though many of them are things that should be changed. And there are plenty of Arab women who are fighting for their rights. There are plenty of women, Arab Christian women, who are speaking very persuasively about the lot of the Arab woman and about how it should be changed and whether the church is interested. And they don't even begin to talk about ordination or some of the things that we think is so important. Because I know one who said, it's not even fruitful to mention ordination. There are other more important things that we have to work on. There's an issue here of this magazine, and I'd be happy to send you a copy if you give me your address. It's put out by the Middle East Council of Churches. It's an occasional magazine, one issue on Jerusalem, one on who are the Christians of the Middle East. This issue's on women in the Middle East. And there's an article in here by Hanan Ashrawi, the woman who speaks for the Palestinian delegation. Other people like this. Here's the woman I was just thinking of, Maud Nahas, who runs the youth work the women's work of one of the Orthodox churches in Lebanon. So I can't say that your images are untrue, but they're a little tiny slice of the truth. And the truth is bigger. And you would find a lot of people who'd like to talk sort of constructively about these things. And some of them would be men, too. But maybe that's enough for the kind of thing that would have to be discussed on that level. If you'll permit me, I'll return to my paper. And I wanted to just list some of these consequences. And we had one here that I think we have to really put down. Demonization. And a very short sketch of that would be for me to say, in my mind at least, can you imagine a war like the Gulf War against a country that we like? What country do we like best?
England,
Canada. Australia, Canada, Norway. Norway has oil. Some of us are Scandinavian background. Could we have done that to Norway? You know, with that willingness of keeping that curtain between us and reality? Those pilots coming back as they strafe the soldiers going north, fleeing, you know, and saying it's like a turkey shootout there. As soon as I gas drop and go back and get some more, you know, this kind of thing. The public would have just said, George Bush, you are insane, you know? They just wouldn't have done it. And it's, the reason we could do it was because of this, I'm sure. We've had Khomeini, Gaddafi, Yasser Arafat, Saddam Hussein, four of the worst people in history in our minds, and they aren't actually that bad, some of them. Yeah, there are Middle Easterners who can give you a different story on some, a couple of them, especially Khomeini and Yasser Arafat. But those guys are all from the Middle East, and Saddam Hussein was just the next in line. They could just take out Khomeini and put him in. They could take out Yasser Arafat, put him in. Take out Gaddafi, put him in. As the bad guy, that we can do that too. And that we can raid. And it was a sanitized war. We had these wonderful technological weapons, which didn't, you know, didn't kill very many of them anyway, even if they were a problem that we were killing them, that kind of thought. The other thing that we've mentioned here is giving comfort to fundamentalism. And I think it's worth saying, or defensible to say, giving comfort to, exacerbating it, promoting it, partaking of it, wallowing in it. We're all doing that, even though you and I aren't fundamentalists, probably. But I think we have shades of fundamentalism in us. We do tend, at some points in our view of the world, to decide that we can't handle any more grays in that area. We got to have some blacks and whites. Excuse me for the imagery, but it's the best term I know for what we're talking about. So we settle for things that really are the stock in trade of fundamentalists, and we really shouldn't. And our media settle for them and use them on us as if they are the truth. And if you just take a little bit of time to look at people's attitudes, you can see how foolish this is. A man named Harold Vogelaar, who was an ELCA missionary in Egypt, wrote a little article in the Lutheran last year, and I copied some things from it. He said, Christians and Christianity, in our minds, it's, what does it stand for? Peace, love, integrity, freedom, openness, justice. Those are all values that we would hold probably pretty close to our ideal, at least, of our religion. Islam and Muslims, in our minds, stands for war, deception, violence, partiality, oppression, oppression of women, oppression of non-Muslims, closeness. That's sort of what we carry around. And all of those things are very quickly, on the downside at least, the same kind of thing that a fundamentalist allows to take over his own view of, his or her own view of the world. But Harold went on and said, what do Muslims think of Christians? Well, then you see that the problem has two sides. Muslims, and this is very general, but it's, there's a lot of truth to it. It comes up in very quick conversations. If you speak to a Muslim over a cup of coffee and you can get into politics, and he or she feels like telling you what he thinks because they're some of the most polite people in the world, he said, they would say, well, Christians are much more divided than Muslims. And what can you say? There are 10,000 denominations. Much more racist, much less tolerant, because they know how much we don't like them. They can feel it. They know what we think of their region. They know what we think of them. Arab Americans, many of them keep a very low profile, partly because of this. How many people, you know, sort of slink along the side of the street during the Gulf War, hoping you didn't find out they were from Lebanon or Iraq or Egypt? That the Westerners, Christians, are less disciplined and less God-fearing. And some of the fundamentalist Muslims will say, if you were serious about your God the way we are, we wouldn't mind you. We wouldn't be so hard on you. But you're not. And instead you send our way not your science, which we respect, not your technology, which we'd like to have, but you send this Hollywood garbage, this pornography, this violence. And there you have a real twist too, because although we accuse the region of violence, our level of violence in terms of personal crime is astronomically greater than theirs. Even we don't have the bombings and things that they have, but we have much more of the armed robbery and rape and crimes of violence. And we also pump violence out to the rest of the world and to our, not to mention our own public, you know, the diet of violence in television and Hollywood.
Do you think some of our negative view, though, came from seeing hours and hours of TV where they're waving flags and burning the American flag and saying,
yeah,
we hate you, we hate your guts?
Absolutely.
Or was that manufactured? Because
no,
it
no.
seems like they really hate us.
That's right. That's right. That that flag waving and burning and hostage taking is, you know, another twist in the screw, because it's, we're focusing on their extreme and using it to form our position. So why on earth are we forming our position of a region based on a thin slice of evidence?
It doesn't seem like a thin slice, I guess that's what
That's right, but that's because...
That's the media.
That's all you know.
But it really is a thin slice? I'm
it
not
is.
Surprised.
Go to Iran.
Really?
Go to Iran. I bet you that 9 people out of 10 will be nice to you, will be friendly to you, will like America, will distinguish between Americans and the American government. Palestinians are the same way. They don't have much reason to like us, but they... Boy, they're, you know, by and large. I mean, of course, you can go and meet some that are angry as hell, and some who just wouldn't give you the time of day. But then you have to also ask what they're reacting to. One day, I was talking to a couple young men, and I thought I could tell why they didn't sort of warm up to me, and it was because I was in running shorts. And in for Muslims, this part of the body, from here to here, is the equivalent of a woman's breast. In terms of public viewing, you know, if you want to go running in a Muslim country, wear long pants. I mean, it's too hot to go running anyway, so don't bother. But I was running in little tiny American running shorts, and I asked them, "Are these shorts okay?" And you could see them gulp at the prospect of telling me what they thought. But they did. They said, "Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, but you basically said you shouldn't be here. You know, go home to your hotel and put on something decent." So I don't know how I got into that, but it's
was this?
Pardon?
Which country was this?
This was in the West Bank, occupied territory. Yeah.
That same thing is true in the Caribbean, which we often ignore by our tourism.
Yeah.
The Caribbean, they're very shocked by the cutoffs and
right.
And women wearing.
And it's not just the Muslims, it's the Christians. There are Christians in the Middle East too. That's, by the way, one of the most important things to get out of this. I've got some material laid out here. There are 10 million Christians there, and they think exactly the same way. And to see a Western tourist or a secular Israeli who are just like, I mean, Israel is a part of the West that's been planted in the region, really, at least half of Israel, the Ashkenazi side. To see people in tank tops. And I've seen people in the Old City, fresh out of the Holy Sepulchre, with their body parts hanging out of their clothes and little hot pants on, and walking next to a Muslim woman, you know. You just wonder what, if they, where were they born, you know, what's going on in their mind. The insensitivity is just amazing. And so we think they're going around burning our flags and keeping us hostage. They think we are just, you know, desecrating their holy places. And they hear reports about promiscuity in the West and AIDS and all these things. I mean, AIDS is not a problem in the Arab world. And it won't be for a long time. It might be the last place where it's a problem. And it's partly related to people's it is related to people's behavior.
How about drugs?
It's there, but very, very hidden. You don't even know how much it is. And I don't think it's bad, but it's more than you think it is. You don't get much.
That's our crime is to a large extent because of our drugs, don't you think?
Oh well, this is about the Middle East. I can't speak. Let me just list a couple more things here that I think we have to really pin as the bill for this imagery. You know, this imagery, you can laugh at it when Indiana Jones shoots the guy with the sword. But it's all part of something much more important that goes far beyond media, but gets a lot of its sustenance from media. And another thing to say is that the real stories don't get told, and the real questions don't get asked. And we've been coming back around on this again and again, in as much as we say that there are crazy people by any definition in Iran, but they are not the Iranian majority by any means. And what do the Iranian people think of their government? What do the Iraqis think of Saddam Hussein? I have not yet met an Iraqi who likes Saddam Hussein. You know? So all these very common sense kinds of things that we would only expect of ourselves when we think of our own government, our own society, we just have to do them the courtesy of using the same common sense questions about their government. A couple examples here about the real story. The Holy Land as a concept, the place that you and I are willing to pay money to go to see. That is not a real story. That is not the real story of the Middle East. That's a little tiny slice of one of the smaller countries, and it's jiggered to fit our worldview and to fit our nostalgia and our piety and our religion in a certain way, that people go there by the hundreds of thousands and millions and come back confirmed in this Holy Land talk. And the Christian punchline would be, they go to see the dead stones, the ruins, and they ignore the living stones. And there are living stones in the biblical sense, the Jesus sense. Christians who go back all the way to Jesus, who've been there since Pentecost, who are not seen by probably 95% of, or 98% of the Western tourists who come to Israel and to see Jesus where he walked, but they ignore the footprints that his disciples are leaving there today, who happen to be Palestinians. Instead, horror of horrors, they put them under the category of all those bad images. They're terrorists. They're people who spray on the side of buildings and demonstrate, and they're trying to make trouble and kill people and do all these acts. So the dissonance is incredible. Another example of the real story would be the peace process. This is not as strong, I think, because the truth is getting out, thanks to people like Hanan Ashrawi, an Arab woman who happens to speak good English. And we require people to talk to us in our language, of course, otherwise they don't sort of exist. She knows our language better than we do, I think. But the real story of the peace process was described by one of the negotiators who was just fresh out of 6 months administrative detention. The Israelis can put anybody they want, according to them, in prison for 6 months and show no cause. They call it administrative detention. They have lots of prison camps for these things. And this guy, Sari Nisabi, a philosophy professor, said that the peace negotiations are like, and they're starting again 2 days ago, and maybe they're going in a better turn, but this was said about 3 months ago. They're like two men negotiating over a glass of water. And as they negotiate, one man is drinking from the glass without comment and putting it back on the table, drinking as they negotiate, but they're negotiating about the glass. Pretty soon there's no glass, there's no water left to negotiate about. And that's very much the reality on the ground in the West Bank. The ground is being taken over plot by plot in numbers. I mean, how many housing units did they talk about freezing here a few weeks ago when the loan guarantees were again granted? 16,000. You go to the West Bank, it looks like a developer's dream because there are cranes and half-finished condominiums everywhere, and they're all on Palestinian land. And this would be a real detour that we don't want to get onto. Yes?
I have to detour just a little. Didn't we read the National Geographic that it is in fact water that we're talking about?
It is also water.
They are taking the water from the Palestinians right now, drilling, slant drilling into their wells and just sucking it right out.
Well, the aquifers for Israel are in under the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And some Israeli politicians are saying that if they give back some land, they won't give back the part that covers one aquifer because that's too important. And you mentioned National Geographic. We get all of our bad news from the big media, I think it's pretty much fair to say, and from our own inadequate education. But occasionally the big media do turn around and take a look at the other side of the coin. And for the first time, I think, in its history, this magazine had a story on the Palestinians. It's the June issue. The one with Lake Baikal on the front. The man spent 6 months taking photos of the Palestinians, and it's a good story on them. You can find things that correct the image, even in the large media.
Can I ask, why does the U.S. support Israel so heavily? And why are they again for the Palestinians?
The large Jewish population.
Yeah, but you know, we didn't start out that way. We were very cold and distant from Israel in the 50s. It was a communist sort of a country. They were socialists, and we didn't like them. But gradually, the 67 war was a big turning point. It was a point at which the story was cooked, and the pot started to boil. Who started the 67 war and why is a very interesting question, and it's not as simple as we think. And since that time, it's been on a roll. And it's been augmented, and I think that's the point where we can get upset, augmented by Christian Zionism. Those of us who think we know what God intends for the world from passages in Ezekiel and Revelations, and think that at the end it's going to be America and Israel versus the rest. And that can go a long, long way worse than what I've just said. If anybody's really interested to read about it, pre-millennial dispensationalism, as the most extreme form of why we support Israel as Christians, there's a book put out by the Middle East Council of Churches trying to explain what is Western fundamentalist Christian Zionism. It takes one to know one. It takes one to make one a fundamentalist. We've got ours to match theirs, and we could have a great debate about that. These kind of people, there's something in Jerusalem called the International Christian Embassy. Go there and learn. Pat Robertson and those guys, I mean, forget it. Just forget it, or go there and try to change them. I wanted a quick example of this. It's like the Gulf War. This case in 1988 of the Iranian airliner, the Airbus that was shot down over the Persian Gulf by our wonderful guided missile cruiser that USS Vincennes. In very much brief words, and if you want to read more, Newsweek about 5 or 6 weeks ago, early June, had a cover story on it. And what they did was go back and look at it again and ask some of the real questions. What happened at the time was we shot down an Iranian airliner. We were shocked. But in the time it took for the news to sort of die down a little bit, the Pentagon gave medals to the people who had acquitted themselves so admirably in action. They showed where the ship was and said that it was not in Iranian territorial waters. By doing that, to do that, they moved an island. They took an island off the map, which would have brought the boundary out to where they were. And this Newsweek article shows that map that they showed, which is missing one of the islands. The actual story was a lot different from that, and in, you know, the end of it was that 290 people who were like you and me got blown out of the sky by this billion-dollar warship whose operators could not even run its own computers properly, who mistook a climbing airliner at 7,000 feet for a diving fighter, an F-14 at 4,000 feet, whose captain was busy chasing Iranian Revolutionary Guards who had little outboard motor speedboats with a little tiny machine gun in the front, and they were harassing shipping at the time. And he was chasing them with the enormous cruiser, and he chased them into their own hideout in these islands. And then somebody said, oh, there's an enemy aircraft coming in, and he wasn't paying any attention, and finally he said, take it out. And they shot it. They put it as an enemy aircraft. They classified it first, and then within, and this happens in 2 minutes, you know. But read the story, it's quite dramatic. Anyway, the point for us is, how did we let the government get away with that? You know, the story was so thin, but it flew, it stuck. And the only reason it stuck was because I think at the back of our minds, without even perhaps saying it to ourselves, it was the Iranians. They're crazy. They're fundamentalists. They're Islamic extremists. They're terrorists. They kept us hostage for 444 days. All those kinds of, they're in this mindless war with Iraq for 8 years. It's just one more tragedy in a terribly tragedy-prone region. And none of that reasoning has anything to do with reality beyond the very narrow sliver of confirmation that we make by looking at always the extremists, always the image, the negative imagery, and laying layer upon layer of negative thought about that part of the world. Just to fill that out a little more, have you ever read a story on the Muslim struggle between the secular and the religious? You know, the trends in Islamic society, where what we have so much here, where the secular seems to be clobbering the religious cold in our modern secular Western civilization. What's the parallel under Islam? How are they dealing with the modern world? It's a wonderful story to perhaps read and then think about with them sometime. How are the Arabs handling all that wealth? Who's getting it? Are the Arabs all rich because of this oil that we need so much from them? Or who's getting it? How are they handling it? What's the effect on the minority who are getting it? What's the effect on the majority who are not getting it? What do they think of the minority who are getting it? Not only within those societies, but within the region where this unique resource, which was formed over millions of years, or whatever it took, is being gobbled up in 100 years by you and my habits. And to the benefit of a very, very small group of people who we then go to war to protect. And we're talking, you know, basically 2 or 3 or 4 million people, maybe. Saudi has 5. These kind of questions. Is the U.S. part of the problem or part of the solution over there? Are we the thin line between disorder and harmony? Or are we part of the disorder and part of the chaos? You know, these kind of questions are... much more informative than yet one more story about who blew up whom and how crazy they are, and the marrying of the words Islamic and fundamentalist, as if they were somehow born together and destined for a life together, or Muslim terrorists, all these kinds of things. Time is flying.
It's this scheme, Jonathan, it's not your scheme.
Are you doing it for me?
I'm doing it for you, so.
We're leaving. Two other things on the consequence side. Who is served by the imagery? And I'll just read you my list. We are, our piety, our nostalgia, our ignorance, our guilt for what we've done in the past, our prejudice. The travel business is served by it because it sells one part of the region real well, and you don't even have to think about the rest. But if there's a way to sell the rest, they'd sell it too. You know, there's Jordan's trying to have a tourist industry if you want to go there. That's where Lawrence of Arabia was filmed. You know, you might like it. The Israeli government and the Israeli lobby here, which is very strong and can knock out congressmen and senators on that issue alone, like Charles Percy was knocked out by a good Lutheran, Paul Simon. They are served by it, the Israelis and the Israeli lobby, and the American Jewish community, those who are in favor of Israel as it has been. The task is of keeping us in oil is simplified because we only have to deal with a few powerful people in the region who control the oil. We don't have to worry about the masses. They get written off underneath the imagery somewhere. We don't even think about them, I think. I'm going too far with some of these statements, but it's part of the problem, I think. And then fundamentalists on both sides are served. Who is victimized? The Arab masses. You know, the you and me Arab. People like us over there are victimized by this. Within that group, there are other subgroups that get special trouble. The Palestinians, almost a bad word, somewhat rehabilitated now, but almost a bad word. And the Arab Christians, a minority within a minority in some of these places, because they're not Muslim, they're Arab. In the West Bank, for example, they're Arab, Palestinian, Christian. About 4 or 5% are Christian.
You see any hope?
Well, if we would do two things, learn a little bit more about it, and from our learning perhaps help our government to step back and get a little bit less involved and less oriented towards the power games that we have over there, they would at least have the chance to see if they could solve it themselves. But our prejudice is that the Arabs can't govern themselves. We have to help them. We have to set up puppets. We have to maintain puppets or generate puppets. And that's been the pattern since this settlement at the end of World War I. I think the more we let the sides over there deal with each other without our intrusion, and we have the benefit of having lost the Soviet meddling in the region. So let's stop the American meddling and let the Palestinians and the Israelis talk person to person without $10 billion hanging over one side's head, or the American Israeli lobby having to be dealt with by both sides. These kind of questions. You had a
something that Saddam Hussein had left all his weapons, they all being used over arsenal and so forth. They would have had a happy ending over there, and he would have ruled the world in a very benevolent manner.
No, I hope I don't sound like that. The problem is that you can never freeze time and say, let's address this problem, because there are always antecedents. Who gave him the weapons?
We did.
Who sold them to him? The Russians and us. Who armed him against Iran to try to contain Iran? We did. So let's back up in front of that one and say, if we hadn't done that, would he be a nice guy? Well, he'd be less dangerous, you know. If we were serious about arms embargoes and serious about telling the defense industry where to go in the world and policing it. I mean, these things all show up, and this becomes, you know, almost real armchair quarterbacking, but it shows up the depravities in our world a lot more than it shows up the depravities of the Arab people. We need international police forces of some kind. The UN has to be able to go in there and stop arms sales, and at the same time perhaps take some of these leaders and take them to a little island and put them on the island and let them sit there for a while. You know, there'd be quite a few people on that island, and some of them might even be our own presidents at various points in our history. If you compare crimes or bad things that we've gotten ourselves into. So the slate isn't clean until you go back. And you know how far you have to go back? 1,000 years. Because we started our problems, at least 1,000 years. We started our problems with the Crusades, if not before. But the Crusades are seen by Arabs as just this incredible episode of barbarians from the West coming in and being better in only one thing, and that is fighting. And there's people over there still today who would say the same thing. The West is better than us in the only thing that counts in this terrible world, and that is might. Might makes right. But if you look at civility, family values, to use a term from our own debates here, hospitality, time for people, culture, music, any number of things. And they'd be looking at a stereotype of us when they say this, you know, and we might not like it, but they're just getting our own treatment back. They would feel like they have a lot to offer, and in some things they're better than us. So how come we always come out on top, you know? There's a tremendous inferiority complex going on there. And when you're talking to Arabs, you get statements about themselves that are shocking to hear. Statements of self-degradation. Statements like, this is really a crazy region. And of course, it's got crazy things. It's got, in a way, it's a more honest region because it has communities of people right in on top of each other. And they've been dispersed by the strife over the years, and they've moved. Take the Armenians, for example. You find pockets of them everywhere. Whereas what did we do? We had this sort of almost empty land, that's the way we saw it at least. And we came in, we had a lot of room, a lot of resources. We had the kind of people who left who were motivated to do something over here. And the rules were all different here. But if we would allow ourselves to hunker back down into our ethnic and religious communities, I bet you we'd be in the same pickle in about 100 years, 200 years, as they are over there, in terms of different kinds of people trying to live with each other. And mixed into it is the Christians. A tiny minority now, but who know how to live with Islam. And they live with it in a much different way than we do. And that raises for us the question, do we want to learn something?